Hi, welcome to episode 68 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tyr. And somewhere geographically, because I'm terrible at maps and directions, is David, our producer and my co-host, who puts up with me for over a year to do this show. Hi, David.
Well, you also put up with me. And I am in Oregon, like in a forest.
So are there moose or something? Or you just said in a forest. Now I've got this weird image of like sprites and mooses. And what's the plural of
no,
moose?
I'm in southern Oregon. So, you know, okay. There's a lot of woods and mountains and marijuana growers.
That's fair. Well, our guest this week is definitely not out in the woods. I'm very, very happy to have Riley and I'm going to screw up your name. I know I am.
McLeod,
because I wanted to say it the other way, and I'm like, wait, which is it? It's okay. People mess up my name, and it's five letters, so we're all good. But we have Riley McLeod from Kotaku with us this week. Hi, Riley.
Hi.
I'm so happy you're here, because I know we kind of like chatted about it, and I was like, oh yeah, I should really like for real invite you to the show. and then you're coming off with another podcast appearance on the 1099 as well.
That's true. That was a lot of fun.
It was, and I learned so much about you that I did not already know.
It's true. I always forget that people don't know. Like, early on at Kotaku, I reviewed The Flame and the Flood, and I started with, oh, I used to live on a boat. And my boss was like, what is your life? And I was like, did I not talk about that? And he was like, no, you never mentioned that. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's cool.
Well, now you know.
Now you know. Most of the comments on that review were, tell us more about the boat. And I was like, oh, come on, guys.
Nice. So let's get our usual spiel out of the way, and then we can get down to the fun stuff, which is conversation with Riley. So for those listening, if it's your first or 60th time talking to us, this is Fresh Out of Tokens. We have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games spreadsheet shop, where we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks, who designed our logo and header. We also have a blog to compliment the show, so follow us over at outoftokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, episode, or guest feedback, feel free to drop us a note at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com, and please follow us on Twitter at outoftokenscast. Musical accompaniment for Fresh Out of Tokens is provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And now, with that long spiel out of the way, let's switch it up this week. David, do you want to start?
Absolutely. We usually begin with, can you tell us a little bit more about you and who you are and what you do?
Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I'm Riley. I am currently the managing editor at Kotaku. Prior to that, I was a freelancer and a freelance editor, and I used to run a press called Topside Press, which was a trans-specific small press doing fiction and nonfiction. I guess that's mostly me. I like to work. I mostly work. And is that good?
That's great.
Sure.
I used to live on a boat.
Well, I mean, obviously work in Kotaku, you've been in gaming for a while. So, you know, other than writing about games, because we have a question about that later, what got you started playing games?
Man, that's such an interesting question that comes up actually for me. I work a lot. I didn't have a lot of games as a kid. I had we had like a couple of PC games. We had Legend of Kyrandia and all that, me and my sister. Because once we got stuck and we called the helpline because we didn't realize that it cost money and my parents were very angry. And I had like a Game Gear as a kid that I had to like beg for, but my parents like weren't really into getting us a console or anything. So it's been interesting to like be in games now, and people will talk about like when I played Nintendo games as a kid, and I'm like, oh, I think my neighbors had Duck Hunt, which is a bit, you know, interesting. But I got back into games probably a bit after college. I started playing PC games again, and I think me and a boyfriend played Portal, and then he dumped me, and then I decided to play Half-Life 2 to sort of be like, because he didn't want to play Half-Life 2 because it had guns, and I was like, well, screw you, I'm going to play it. And from there, just sort of started playing a lot of PC games, and but later than that, started writing about games, and now play games all the time. And feel like, I guess I got more seriously into games as an adult as opposed to like a kid, which is, you know, like good and bad, I think, but Yeah.
It makes sense. Right. Yeah. Consoles take up a lot of space. Where would you put them on your boat?
Yeah, right? Like, where would you... it's weird. Like, I full disclosure, still don't own a console. And now probably have to get one. But also, like, I built a gaming PC. So I'm like, what do I need a console for? And there are lots of, like, great console exclusives. And so I've, like, finally hit the point where I'm like, ah, I have to buy a console. But, like... just as I decided, that's it, I'm buying a console, like, all the systems announced new consoles, and now I'm like, ah, which one? Curses! If people listening to this have advice about which console I should buy, I can't decide.
My very biased opinion is a PS4.
That's what everybody says.
Well, okay, so, good friend of ours, good friend of the show, Javier Payano, got me an Xbox One as a donation to the work that I do.
Aw.
It's very sweet of him, and I love him dearly. However, I barely turn on the Xbox.
Oh.
And if the folks at Gaming for Everyone hear this, I'm sorry. But, you know, I mean, well, it's also the factor of I find the UI very confusing.
Yeah.
Like today, I'm in the Xbox preview program, and I was trying to figure out how to look for clubs because that's something you can do now. Mm. I had to Google, I spent about 20 minutes, and I finally found it, like, tucked away on, like, the third screen of the home area, and I'm just like, this is too hard to find.
So frustrating.
You know,
I think I mentioned on Josiah's podcast, but I have a master's in library science, and I'm obsessed with menus, so it's just like, well, that's a terrible menu, like, why would you put that information so far down? Like, that makes me very mad.
I would also recommend the PS4 as your next step, but just because you already have a gaming PC, there's like cross-pollination between it and Microsoft, I imagine.
Yeah, especially now, too, because they're doing a whole more cross-platform thing. Did you know? Yeah, I like the PC. I feel like it gets a bad rap, but I don't know. Keyboard and mouse, man. Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely something special about it.
Yeah.
So the next question we have is what made you make the jump, or what made you want to make the jump from playing games to writing about them? Yeah. Do you have like a specific story or anything?
I at the time that I was playing lots of games was a freelance writer and editor, and had, like all freelancers, a million jobs. And games writing had been something I had really wanted to do that would have been a nice change from, like, you know, editing long things for clients. And I think I got into it very seriously. I've written about this before at Unwinnable. It's kind of a sad story. But I'd run this press, and I'd had this sort of long-term collaborative relationship that I got out of with a friend, and we did a lot of important work, but it wasn't a very healthy relationship, and it took me a long time to be like, I have to do something else. And so, like, pursuing games writing more seriously was kind of the way that I started coming back to, like, my sense of myself and my work without this other person. And it was the, you know, the thing I was going to do to try to, you know, figure out who I was now that I was, like, solo writer me. And it was great. it is still great. And so it was just like an exciting way to sort of branch into a new field and put some of the thoughts I had about games down on paper and take some of the things I'd learned from the many other fields in which I worked and like meet new people and you know, find my way as like who I was in a different sphere. And it's great. I mean, I've met so many awesome people and done so many awesome things, and I've always been like really excited about it. I think it's, as evidenced by us all talking, I feel like the games writing community is by and large like incredibly friendly, and I've met so many awesome people who are supportive of my work and people whose work I'm supportive of. And even though it feels like it should be very competitive, at least to me, it like seldom really feels that way. Like, especially when I was freelancing, I feel like everybody went out of their way to help each other all the time. And that was like really great.
Yeah. I've never really got a sense of like, no, you can't pitch to like this place because I want to pitch there. And I had this idea. It's like, you know, there's enough stories to go around, right?
Yeah. It's surprising because I think, especially when I think about the like freelance ecology, especially on the internet, like it is at its core incredibly competitive. Like there is not enough money and not enough opportunities to go around at all. But I at least never really felt that on the ground at all. And maybe I was just very lucky to, you know a lot of really great people, but it felt like, and continues to feel so easy to be, you know, proud of people when they got opportunities, even if they were opportunities I wanted. You know, I was never like, oh, I can't believe they wrote that piece at this place. I was always like, hooray. And, you know, always still try to think about that stuff now. And yeah, everybody's great.
When you were freelance editing, were you in any of the trade unions or associations?
No, there's a freelance union, but at the time that I was freelancing, it was a bit too expensive. I am now, because I work at Kotaku, a member of the Writers Guild of America East, which I love. Unions are fantastic, and I love being in one. And that's been like one of the super awesomest things about my job is being in a union. I have my little union card, and I have like a little union button on my bag, and I'm like, yeah. I was talking to a freelance friend about this recently. Like, I like the idea of a freelancer's union, but I think that it's, the system is set up such that, like, I don't know how you would really enforce those demands, you know? If that was a question, sorry.
Well, the one I'm in, they run their own job board, and that has been extraordinarily helpful because, you know, most of the time people only post jobs with the union if they meet their recommendations.
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing that's weird about when I was doing freelancing that wasn't straight up games writing is people are so shady about how much you should charge. And I think that in other fields, you always have the ability to undercut someone. And I remember I used to look at the rates of the Editorial Freelancers Association, which is what I would like base my rates off of. But it's such a fine line because someone can always get what you're doing cheaper, and it winds up making it, you know, harder for everybody. I found that people were very secretive about how much you should charge. And
yeah, I'm actually in the EFA.
Oh, nice. I love the rate chart. Yay. I mean, I think charging by the hour for a lot of writing stuff and editing stuff I've always found it to be really tricky because it's like, it involves so many things. And I think I'm also, you know, was and still am terrible at figuring out what my time is worth. And I think probably, you know, a lot of people are, because we're just not really taught to do that. And I think especially like when the economy tanked, like it got hard to, you know, I think at least for me, like my considerations became very different, and I was maybe willing to do work much cheaper than I should have. And then it sort of messed up my entire sense of how much I should be charging, and I made it work.
Yeah.
You know, at my peak had, you know, 7 jobs or something. I remember being out, I was out in Astoria, Oregon many years ago, which is where they filmed The Goonies. I don't know where you are in Oregon right now, but it was this incredibly beautiful town, and I had climbed this hill where Lewis and Clark first saw the Pacific, and there were sea lions, and it was beautiful, and I was like on my phone arguing with a client about something, and it was like a moment where I was like, oh my God, like stop, like wait, you're somewhere beautiful, like stop arguing about money and like look out at the beauty of nature. And I think freelancing is really hard that way, right? Like my joke that I always say about this is the flip side of working from home is living at work. And I think it's so easy, especially for me, like to just dive into work and never come back up. And it's such a hard balance, especially when you're cobbling things together so, you know, willy-nilly all the time.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, like what I've started to do, because I'm not in any kind of writers union, is think about like what's the most I've been paid for a piece and think about how much time realistically will it take me to write this, and consider drafts and rewrites and revisions because no one turns in a perfect piece.
Yeah, I feel like Gita Jackson was talking about this on Twitter recently about the effort that people put into freelance pieces. And I know like last year there was, at least in games, a big talk about what certain outlets pay, and that's, you know, dot 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 is tricky, right? And so I've definitely in games writing in the past too put in immense amounts of work for not nearly comparable sums, and I think it can be a really hard line to understand, like, because you always want to, at least I always want to do the very, very best job I can, and I've definitely had all kinds of jobs where I'll have to at some point step back and be like, you know, stop, like they're paying you X sum and you should do X amount of work for that money, and then you should, like, you're not doing anybody favors going above and beyond, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, because they're getting more than their fair share out of you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people talk. They'd be like, well, so-and-so wrote for me for, like, $50. Right. So why are they charging you $200?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, being on the other side of that now, I definitely understand that there are, at least in game zoning, very different constraints. Yeah, it's hard, man. It's, I don't know how we solve... I mean, you know, I don't know how we solve capitalism, which I guess is not necessarily the topic of this podcast, but...
we wander down that way on occasion.
Yeah. All right, that's the
problem. We did the other day, so...
Yeah.
I mean, capitalism and, you know, the value of things that we... the value we assign things versus their actual worth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, I mean, that comes down to games writing, comes down to making games and what we're willing to pay for games. I mean... I love games. I've been a big nerd about it for half my life, or more than half my life. But I still kind of make a face when I see a special edition come out that costs like $200 and some when the game is $60.
Yeah, it's so tricky. And I think that also filters down to how, you know, the dreaded how long a game is versus how much it costs, right? And I at least hate that we, I hate that we make our decisions that way. But at the same time, if I'm, you know, I'm not going to pay $60. Well, that's not true. I'm probably not going to pay $60 for a two-hour game. Probably. I might, right? But, like, conflating that value, I think, is ridiculous and gives us these long, padded-out games. And it's such a, yeah, like, it's such a weird system and what it means. And what it means to feel like you got your money's worth out of a game. And
yeah, because... Yeah. I got the Order 1886 for $10, and I still feel cheated. But that's a whole other story.
Really?
But, you know, also, in like a single linear single player game, if you compare it to like a movie, like we don't think movies should be more should cost more if they're longer. But like the average movie length and the average amount of money it takes to watch a movie, if the game's about 10 hours long, that's what you paid for.
Yeah, right.
anything other than that is just above and beyond or inflated.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, short games are great, right? I think, you know, Firewatch or Gone Home or all kinds of things. Or, yeah, you get it on sale. And something I've really appreciated about working at Kotaku is... my boss, Steven, had talked to me early on about, like, when we're doing a review, we're not telling people it's worth your money, right? Because I don't know what your money is worth. And I love, like, not... maybe my first secret instinct was, like, this game costs $60. Is it worth your $60? And he was like, that doesn't mean anything. Like, you don't know these people. $60 could be so much money or no money. Like, think of something else. And that has, like, always really helped me shape what it means for me to review things. It's also tricky, right? I still think that when a new game is coming out and it's $60, and I'm like, oh man, I don't know. I really want to buy the new Witcher edition. Full disclosure, I've never played The Witcher 3. It's terrible.
What?
It's not terrible. It's terrible that I haven't played it. I know, it's like ridiculous. But still, even now, I'm like, oh, it's like $40. And I hate making those calculations where I'm like, God, of course you should. I'm certain it's worth your $40.
I know. That was just my what?
No, I know. It's really shameful.
No, because I actually restarted playing it today.
Right. I know. Everybody's talking about it now. And I'm just like, this is the moment. I'm gonna get in on it. It just sort of never happened.
I'd say definitely it's worth $40 because just on the base game, because I'm not high level enough for the DLC, I've put in at least 80 to 100 hours.
I mean, I bought Human Revolution on sale for $5 and have played 127 hours of it, I think, according to Steam. So, like, definitely the best $5 or whatever I ever spent. Like, absolutely.
I'm not on board with Deus Ex. Fuck them, man. What?
Man, come on. Adam Jensen.
Adam Jensen aside, the whole their whole Letitia, the trash lady, sounded like Step and Fetch It.
I actually never talked to her. I managed to avoid her, and then I found out about her, and I was like, oh, I'm glad I never talked to her. Which is just interesting about, you know, open world games. I think I had never played a game like that when I played Human Revolution, and so it really like kind of exploded my mind just about how games could be played, I guess. I'm willing to hold that it's probably not as great as I, you know, remember it being, but it's still I still love it.
I mean, it's entirely possible. I got it for $10 on Xbox 360 and got through maybe 40 minutes, and I was like, the mechanics were shitty. I hate it. And then I went back, and I was just like, oh, Letitia, okay, goodbye. Screw you, game.
I mean, I wish that they... I think that game falters the most when it tries to talk about issues. And there, I actually just watched the Aaron Signal video about Mankind Divided, which was fantastic, and you should all watch it. And it was talking about how they try to employ metaphors for so many things that it winds up being a bit, you know, meaningless. And I think I just sort of, in Human Revolution and Mankind Divided, I cover my ears a little bit when they try to talk about issues. And I'm just like, look, I just want to climb around in vents and knife arms people. Like,
that's fair.
And now on the Illuminati and crazy cyberpunk stuff, like... wacky cyberpunk stuff, like, just, you know, just give me a stealth game, come on. I just want Deus Ex. I don't want your opinions on the issues of the day.
Yeah, it gets really tricky to talk about contemporary issues when the core of your narrative is conspiracy theories.
Yeah, right.
The first game was about the Illuminati, the second one was about, like, the Knights Templar.
Yeah. I mean, right, definitely.
Huh. Interesting. We when I see you in person, Riley, we should drink and talk about these games. What?
Deus Ex is the best. But I also... Yes.
Okay, before we start shouting at each other, I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, your history of being an editor and a writer, because, like I said, it was really fascinating learning a lot of your backstory on listening to you on 1099. And I was just like, so I never knew all this about Riley. What the hell? So, you know, like, how did all of your past gigs kind of factor into, you know, getting a staff position at Kotaku?
A lot. I think I, you know, had so many, I feel like a lot of, I'm constantly shocked to learn how many games writers are so young. Like, I feel like I remember when Kara Ellison turned 30 and I was like, you're only 30? What? Whereas I feel like I had sort of jumped around from job to job, and, you know, I'd run a publishing company, I'd been an editor, I'd worked in libraries, I'd worked at another publishing company, largely came from print, and I think all those skills meshed really well with what Kotaku was looking for in a managing editor, which is a very different position than being a writer or a staff writer. Like, I think they were hopefully impressed with my editing skills, and also a lot of the dealing with people and managing schedules kinds of things that I brought to the table from my other fields. And so I think all of those skills just, like, coalesced really well. I had been the managing editor of Haywire magazine for a little while, which continues to be a games writing site. And so I'd managed our schedules and our edits. And so, like, that's all been really great. My library degree comes in handy all the time, which is great. Just the other day, we were talking about fair use, and I was like, well, did you know? Fair use, blah, blah, blah. And also, like, drives me to think a lot about how our information is searchable, how we keep our schedules and our records and what people are working on. And we use Trello for a lot of our record keeping, and I'm constantly moving it around and thinking about it and just like, well, is this really a category? And like, ugh. If I could just make, like, spreadsheets and databases for everything, I would probably do that. And then I had also, had been a chaplain for a while and a social worker for a while. And that comes in handy all the time, I think, in managing people. Maybe sometimes too much. I think I'm sometimes overly concerned with how many people are feeling. But I think a lot of managing and a lot of, especially managing writers and managing people in a high stress, busy environment is this sort of, you know, the ability to think about where people are at and to, sometimes I jokingly call myself feelings boss, which I don't know if they would say, but I'm always like, well, how do you feel about this? And so I think that stuff helps a lot too. And I think, like, being a managing editor and being an editor in general is such an odd career. I was thinking about this a while ago. Like, I don't think any young kids are like, I'm going to grow up to be an editor.
Plan B.
Yeah, but I actually, like, I love it, right? Like, I love helping people and helping them make their pieces the best they can be, you know, whether or not that's what they want. And I love it. I sometimes think that I'm, you know, I like editing not more than writing, or I don't want to say like I'm a better editor than I am a writer, but like sometimes I look at my skills as an editor and I feel like good at it, and it's a weird skill set to have and to understand and to have like grown into over the years, but it's super satisfying. I have a colleague who I was talking to about being a games writer, and he was like, "Oh, I really want to be an editor," and I was like, "Yes, I have succeeded!" Like, and even for me, like having been an editor, I often didn't have editors on things, and being in Kotaku, like. Our EIC, Steven, will edit me sometimes, and it's always the best. Like, having an editor is always the best. Like, one really great thing he had told me was, like, I'll often struggle to end pieces, and he was like, secret, 90% of the time when you can't do that last graph, you don't actually need it. And I was just like, oh, you're right! Like, oh my god! Editors, yay! Like, I think an outside person is so good at cutting that stuff that you're attached to because you're being precious or smart or nervous or whatever, you know, and like I love being able to support people in making their best work, you know.
Yeah. And it is true that managing writers and requires an extraordinary degree of empathy.
Yeah.
You mentioned on the 1099 podcast that you have a degree in theology.
I do.
Were you planning on becoming clergy or just interested?
Yeah, I had done my undergrad in playwriting, and then around the end of that had always been sort of religious as a kid. We had been raised Jewish, and then I'd gotten a little bit Christian in the high school, and then in college was studying Zen Buddhism very seriously. And was really into that, and had taken like lay vows, and went to Harvard Divinity School to study that, and was thinking about getting ordained. And then my second year there, I started working with the Jesuits as a prison chaplain for a while, and had also discovered anarchism. And I think I just got very, very angry, and I got really frustrated with American Buddhism and its racial politics, and it's some of the politics I saw around prison things, and just got really frustrated. And some of that was right, and some of that was me also being like a young anarchist and getting very into like what is good and what is bad, while also practicing a religion that is not about that. And so sort of regretfully moved away from that, but I'm still like very religious, though I'm hard pressed to say what that means. And at least every 6 months regret that I will probably never be a Jesuit. I think in another life I would have done that. And yeah, I mean, it was good. I think like people in my communities have varying feelings about religion that I often understand. Like, I think I'm very, very privileged that I've never been like burned by religion personally. Like, my religion has never told me I'm going to hell or made me cry, and so I'm able to be kind about it and patient with faith and the complicated things that faith are. And I understand that other people don't feel that way, but it's definitely like something that's very important to me, and I do often regularly sort of regret not going down that path, but try to bring those things into my life. Like, I definitely, in a weird, like, to sound high-minded, often sometimes see editing the same way that I saw a chaplaincy, in a kind of way. Like, it's a way to be of service to people and help them, you know? Like, that sounds like sort of highfalutin and silly, but I just like helping. Which they often tease me about at work, where I'll often be about to leave and then something will happen and I'll still be around. They're like, why are you still here? And I'm like, I'm helping. Somebody needs help. Yeah, mostly my theology degree makes me weird at parties, which is, you know, pretty good.
Weird at parties?
Yeah, you know, someone's like, oh, I grew up a Baptist. And I'm like, oh, well, did you know? Blah, blah, blah. And they're like, uh-huh, okay, cool, weird. My sister converted to Southern Baptism a couple of years ago, so that's been really interesting. Yeah, no, she gets a bit conservative sometimes, and she'll be like, well, did you know Jesus says? And I'm like, did he, though? Like, I don't want to be that guy. I went to Harvard for Bible. Did he say that? Are you sure? Which is yeah, super shitty.
But some days you got to do that.
Yeah, sometimes it starts to be a bit important, I think. So that's like pretty good. She called me up once early on, and she was like, "Is Jesus dead?" And I was like, kinda, yeah. And she's like, "Is that important?" And I'm like, "It's super important, yeah." And she's like, okay, thanks. And I was like, "Okay, good luck. Good luck, buddy. Good luck with your choices."
Wow.
She's like way out in the South, and everybody in her town is a very conservative Southern Baptist, so she decided that's what she was going to do. And she, ooh, you know, jumped in.
Bless her little heart.
Yeah, yeah, it's many things. Because like another time the other day, she had a garden, and they had a lot of food, and she called me, and they lived next to like a much poorer sort of urban like city community. Like, I'm not saying urban is a code for something, like actually a city as opposed to the country. And she was like, "Well, why can't I just bring my vegetables down and just like give them away? Like, isn't that what Jesus would want?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she's like, "Well, I looked it up, and I guess it's like illegal." And I was like, "Yeah, it's weird, right?" And she's like, "Well, but Jesus would want me to just do it, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, he would. Yes, the cool kind of Christian." And so I like when it inspires her to think that way. As opposed to, you know, divorce is a sin, and we haven't really gotten into like queer and trans conversations, and I am hoping that we just will not talk about whatever her religion is telling her about that. And I just try to pretend that's not part of our relationship. So
I know that feel, because my mother is very Catholic, Vatican II
nice.
Catholic. So yeah, there's just things we don't talk about.
That went to a complicated place. I almost thought it was going to be the story of how you got your sister arrested.
That would have been cool. One day. Nah, she's cool. We're twins, and she was in the army, and we're very different people. But she's cool.
Well, I hope so.
She's got it, yeah.
So we talked about freelancing quite a bit, but, you know, we can always keep talking about freelancing because it's of interest and it's something like, you know, all of us are doing or have done. So, you know, you brought it up when you're on the 1099, but I was just wondering, do you find people who are like really, really into freelancing or people maybe that have written one article here or there have this romanticized idea that it's like, oh my God, it's freeing and I have all this time and it makes money?
No, do you? I don't know. I think most freelancers who are working at it feel like it's, you know, it's a grind. And they think, you know, being a freelancer versus being on a staff is obviously, you know, obviously really different. I think, well, it's hard. I mean, you do have more freedom as a freelancer, right? You're not subject to a lot of the demands and the things you have to think about when you're working on a website. But the flip side of that is you're always hustling and you have to sell certain kinds of ideas and you have to sell, you know, I think like something I like about Kotaku is that we stay with the life of a game for a long time. And something that I always found really hard with games freelancing was it'd be like, okay, you know, Fallout 4 is coming out and I am going to, you know, have to shell out $60 for it. And I have a window of like 2 weeks to write about it before nobody will pay me to write about it again. And then there's the next game. And I always found that like just to be really difficult with freelancing. And especially if you didn't have an in with a place, like I feel like when I was freelancing, ideas became unsellable much more quickly. And that just constant hustling and thinking and pitching. And I also think it affects like the kinds of stories you pitch. Like I don't, you know, you probably can't be a news freelancer, right? Unless you're doing these like long investigative pieces that take a long time. And so like definitely switching to Kotaku and having to think about more news was a bit of a wake up call for me, because I had often thought in, you know, big concept sort of evergreeny pieces, because, you know, the time between when you sell a piece to a site and when it actually goes up can be, you know, ages. And so having to learn to be a lot more immediate and to follow a lot more things that are currently happening has been, you know, good and bad, I think. it's definitely been like, and I talk to our writers that we have who've come from freelancing about this a lot. Like, there's something really exciting, I think, about working for a site and being able to write a small thing and being like, here's a neat thing, or here's a funny thing, or here's, you know, you don't have to justify it being on the page, right? Like, you get a salary. You can write 600 words if they're sharp, smart, good words, and that's, like, okay. And I think there's a certain training yourself out of that freelancer mentality that I think it's a struggle, but it's also really great. And I think especially working for a formerly Gawker site, I guess, is which I guess we could also talk about, is that the company has such a sharp, brave aesthetic that has really taught me a lot about how I want to, how I can write things and how to be confident and concise. And so, yeah, it's, to answer your question, I don't know of many freelancers who would call it freeing as opposed to constantly, constantly stressful,
Well, what about the people who like have no real clue about freelancing, who
right.
think like, oh, well, you know, you get to write stuff and blah, blah, blah. It's like, do you know how stressful that shit actually
is? You never get to write stuff. I mean, 90% of your day as a freelancer is begging people to let you write stuff. Like, I think at least, and I always hated, you know, the hustle of finding clients and doing the businessy stuff. I never enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, what you do. Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
So I got out. See ya, suckers. No. That's sad.
So what is the most ridiculous thing you've heard someone believe about freelancing?
I was thinking about this before. Gosh. I mean, I guess it's that you get to wake up whenever and sit around in your pajamas all day and set your own hours and do whatever you want. Like, I think freelancing has, like, I definitely understand people, you know, and even when I was working office jobs, being like, oh, I wish I could freelance, and then moving to freelancing, it's just, I think you really are just constantly working. Like, it's not this awesome vacation where you can do whatever you want. Like, you're responsible for everything that you do. You have to pay horrifying, confusing taxes that are a nightmare. It's the worst part of, it's not the worst part of freelancing. I think it's sometimes less you can kind of do whatever you want and more responding to different demands and, you know, just the cobbling things together constantly, I think. I feel like I sound down on it because I've, you know, escaped.
Well, I mean, it is what it is, and I'd rather have someone, you know, tell the unvarnished truth about it than sell this kind of bright and shiny lie about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think it's really hard in games. Like we've talked about before, there's not a ton of money to go around, which really sucks.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you all find games freelancing? What do you think?
Me?
I haven't done much. It's too expensive to do consistently.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like
Tanya, you were saying. I'm sorry.
that's okay. I was just like, for me, it's the waiting game of, hey, I pitched you a thing, and then I don't hear from you for a week or a few days. Or it's like, I sort of like this, but how about this? And then it turns into nothing at all like what I pitched. And then I kind of...
Yeah.
Kind of sort of go, okay, well, this is what you said you wanted. And then, you know, what do you do if you go through all of this? Because I had that experience with one place where it's like, here's what I've pitched you. Here's your feedback.
Yeah.
This is the feedback. Okay, I changed it based on your feedback and back and forth and back and forth, and then still no peace. And I've wasted how much time when I could have been writing something else.
Yeah, that's like having now been on sort of both sides of that. Like I've definitely pitched things that outlets have, especially stuff about like giant finger quotes diversity, where I've pitched a thing to an outlet and they've we've talked about this, I think. Like, they've warped it into being something that I am not necessarily comfortable with, and that kind of thing is, like, happened to me. But on the flip side, like, now being managing editor of a big site and receiving pitches is, like, sometimes there are things that I need, and I don't think a pitch is quite the angle that I need it to be, or that meets my needs, or is strong enough, and, like, I always try to respect, you know, the time of my freelancers and not go back and forth and do a ton of edits and stuff. And it's hard. Like, there's definitely a give and take based on, you know, what you pitch and what a site needs. But I think it's also, you know, sometimes I think when a pitch is rejected from a site, like, now that I'm especially being on the other side, is like, it isn't necessarily the quality of the pitch. Like, I'll get awesome pitches that sometimes I already have covered or just don't fit with, you know, my focus on a thing or whatever. And in terms of how long people take to get back to you, like, yeah, I'm definitely guilty of that.
Well, I haven't pitched you yet, so.
But it's hard. I think it's important to stand your ground on a piece if it's what you want, but also to be open to, you know, like, writers, I feel like as an editor, I can work best without people who are open to edits and suggestions because they believe that I, as their editor, have, you know, their best interests in mind, but who will also step up to me if I'm misinterpreting or I'm trying to turn something into something they're not comfortable with. And I always try to hold, like, you know, if not to change the core of what they're saying, and stuff like that.
Yeah, but, well, since we already kind of started talking about pitching, this actually rolls really well into our next question. What tips would you have for someone who does want to pitch to, like, you or, you know, or other game sites, or just in general? Because I feel like a lot of people get stuck on the pitch before they've even written anything.
Yeah, I do believe that my own site, Haywire, has a, I think Haywire has a guide about pitching, which you should all read. I would probably say pitch : possible title in your subject line. Be clear that you're sending me a pitch in your subject line. I get a lot of email, and it can be very confusing. The pitches I respond to the best are the ones that are very clear. Like, don't write the piece for me. Like, don't ever attach your entire draft in a pitch. That's ridiculous. Like, you don't have to write the pitch in the email. Like, you don't have to write the piece in the email. Sell me, like, concisely, like, what your idea is, why it's meaningful right now, and why you're the person to write it, you know? And I think that's really hard. And I definitely was not always as good at that as I, you know, could have been. But just, like, you know, really try to think about and hone and sharpen your idea into something unique that you can offer that my site might, you know, need or want. Like, and I know, at least for us, like, that can be tons of things. Like, if there's, like, I think, you know, like, think about, too, like, what, if you're pitching to bigger sites, like, what their coverage already looks like, you know? Like, if a site is constantly writing about, like, you know, trying to, you know, we're all playing Overwatch right now, you know, at my job. So, like, if you have something that's very similar to stuff we already have, like, that's not a bad idea. It's just obviously, like, we've got that need met. So if you've got a need, like, pitches I personally like a lot are often, like, something that's ironically hard about working on a staff is you're often, you know, way too busy to spend a ton of time in certain games. And so, like, people who, you know, we have a regular freelance contributor right now who writes about Minecraft because he is, like, really involved in Minecraft. And that's, like, so, it's such a valuable, like, service for us as people who just don't have the time to, you know, be constantly playing those things. So, like, definitely, you know, thinking about the place you're pitching to and finding the niche you can fill that is maybe not being filled. And just, yeah, be concise. Following up is good, but following up too much is less good, which is, you know, like, really vague. And it's, at least for me now as an editor, it's always good to follow up because half the time I probably thought I responded and didn't. So, like, you know, you're definitely not bothering an editor, I'd say, by following up, you know, a week or a week and a half later just to be like, oh, I want to make sure you saw it. but also knowing when they're probably not going to take it, right? But that's the same for, you know, looking for jobs or anything, you know? And, like, I think in general, right, like, don't get discouraged. Like, if your thing's not right for a place, like, it doesn't mean your ideas are bad. Keep trying. Also, like, you know, there's so many places to write. And something I love about writing on the internet, or the way that publishing has changed since, you know, the printing press or whatever, I guess, is, like, if there's a thing you want to do, like, you can just do it, you know? Like, I think about Brendan Keogh's Spec Ops The Line book a lot, right? And he just wrote this book, and he published it. And, like, if you have a thing that nobody will buy from you, you can also, like, you can just do it, you know? Like, yeah, don't let people, you know, dictate your dreams, like. And I think that's, you know, really, and places like Critical Distance, with whom I used to work, you know, highlight writing people do on their blogs, like, practice your games writing, you know. Having clips is always great. I always like seeing clips of people's work and stuff. Yeah. Does that help?
Oh, that helps quite a bit. You know, I like to think of it too in terms of, like, you know, talking about, you know, going to panels and things like that, you know, because when you submit panels to places, it's kind of like a pitch for the panel.
Yeah, totally.
So I try to think of it that way, except, you know, instead of writing something, you're going to sit there on a stage, hopefully, and talk about this thing for 45 minutes or an hour.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think it's always hard, at least for me, it was always, like, why I'm the person to write this, because it feels so cocky, right? Right, it's been a panel, and I'm like, I'm smart, listen to me. And I'm like, no, what? That's so presumptuous.
No, it's not.
And I think, you know, there is a level of selling yourself that you have to do that is, you know, incredibly uncomfortable. But yeah, and I guess another thing I would say about that too, thinking about it now, is, like, especially pitching to bigger sites, is, like, a lot of us have a particular budget set aside for freelance and stuff like that, and so sometimes a pitch could be really great and it's just a bad time for the site, you know, fiscally or whatever. And that's a thing to keep in mind. It's not something I've thought about, you know, thinking about the shift from games freelance to being a staffer, and when we talk about what sites pay. And I think Stu from Unwinnable had that, or David Walensky started, no, wait. Anyway, there was a chart a while ago about what sites paid, and I think that's dictated by a lot of things, and that can sometimes influence, I think, how pitches are accepted and stuff too.
Cool.
That sounded a little shady.
No, but it's true.
Like, there's, yeah, I mean,
I primarily worked in fiction publishing, so.
But there's no money.
Yeah, and it's very clear, you know, it's just part of the thing is, like, we pay so many people, and then when there's no more money, that's it.
Right, and that sucks, like.
Unlike a monthly cycle or a quarterly cycle.
Yeah, definitely, and I think, you know, all kinds of things can influence that, and. I mean, I wish there was more money in writing and in online writing and in games writing altogether. And I think I talked about this in the 1099 too. It's like, you know, the models are so tricky, and I don't know. I wish there was more money for everybody.
Yeah, definitely.
But I also think we're seeing that change a lot too, like the makeup of sites and people moving to different things. And I don't know. We'll find a way, I think.
Yeah, I think we may be figuring out different ways of moving money around with new technology that may have huge impacts.
Yeah.
We wanted to ask, have you ever written about a game and had different feelings and opinions from at the end of writing as compared to the beginning?
Yeah, I think I've, like, gotten into things that I maybe wasn't that excited to play and then found myself excited about them, or been excited about things and lost my excitement for them. I think something that's really interesting about, like, playing a game for review is you play it so much and you have to beat it, and sometimes you don't have a lot of time, and I always try really hard not to ever let that color my perception, but I also recognize that sometimes I'm interacting with a thing, you know, in a very different way than the other people might be. And I think that can sometimes just be, like, really difficult. I mean, like, I felt that way about, like, Hyperlight Drifter, maybe, which I reviewed for Kotaku, which was so fun, but was really hard. And I tend not to be a very good or a really huge fan of very, very hard games, but having to try to beat it in, like, you know, the amount of time I had, like, I think I had to be very aware of when I was frustrated because I had been sitting there for, you know, 12 hours versus, like, you know, how if you could walk away and come back and if it was a game that you could come to. I think I try to be really aware of the ways that you play games when you're reviewing them and whether or not, you know, people who are just playing them will think that way. So something that I find super interesting about, like, game reviews or games writing, especially now that I work for a big outlet, is that you have to be, I feel like, very knowledgeable in an interesting way. So I try to always be aware when if I'm playing a game and I'm like, the menus are obtuse, I'm automatically like, well, why do I think that? Like hold on, like, what, where are you sure it's not just you? Are you misinterpreting? Let's start again, let's look at the tutorial again. Like, are you sure that that's, like, you know, correct? And I often find, like, a lot of sort of pressure there, but also, like, enjoy having to, I don't want to say, like, I'm not going to say objectivity because I don't necessarily believe that that is a thing, but trying to think about where my claims are coming from. And I think, like, games and the experience of playing a game is so subjective that it's an interesting challenge to have to sort of separate both those things, right? Is the game frustrating or am I frustrated? Is the game hard or do I not have those skills? Like, and that's sort of a very interesting line to walk a lot of the time, I think.
Cool. Because, I mean, there were games that I had feelings about and then played them, and it's like, huh, I was actually wrong.
Yeah, I feel that way about Wolfenstein The New Order, which J.B. Gwaltney loves. Where, like, someone had bought it for me, and I was like, this is some dumb shooter trash. And I've been sick on New Year's, and I couldn't go to a party, and so I made a bunch of hot toddies, and I was like, oh, I'm going to play Wolfenstein. That game is the best! Like, oh my god, it's so good! And, like, warm and caring and, you know, goofy, but, like, kind. And it was this game that I thought was just some, you know, stupid bro shooter, and then I was like, this game is, like, the greatest! And I love that. Like, I love being proven wrong about things that I have. Or even, like, Overwatch. Like, I never would have played Overwatch if my colleagues weren't playing it, or if I wasn't. I think if I wasn't working at Kotaku, I would have been like, that's a multiplayer shooter. The worst thing that's ever existed. Oh, it has voice chat? No, that's the worst. But now I'm like, oh, this game's great. Which is cool, right?
Yeah, I'm having a little FOMO over Overwatch because I literally get motion sick.
Oh, no.
And so, like, I can't watch streams of it. And right now, I'm just like, well, I guess I'll never watch Twitch again because everyone's streaming Overwatch.
I feel that way about VR.
It's weird. I don't know. I feel a way about VR. I think it's just going to be a fad again because right now it's out of the price range of most people.
People don't have it, and that's, like, hard. A PSVR might change that. I mean, there's talking back to what we're talking about consoles. I mean, one good thing about consoles is you know your console can play PSVR. We're like, having a PC, it's like you have to have, you know, a certain high-end machine and then this incredibly expensive hardware. And I don't know, we had them in the office and it was, like, fun to play with. I don't know if I would. I don't think I would ever. I would play Elite Dangerous in VR, like, hardcore. That's the only reason I could see. I don't think I would ever buy VR, like, personally, but, man, I bet that's the best.
See, I'm also afraid I'll be that person who, like, runs off a balcony or something.
Yeah. When my boss was first trying out the Oculus, I was, like, you know, being very chaplainy, like, tottering behind him with the cord, being, like, very, very nervous. I'm like, be careful. I've got you. It's okay. You just get very nervous. Don't fall. It also takes up an immense amount of room.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got a decent-sized apartment. I still don't trust it. Like, I was leery about even getting a Kinect.
I think the smartest thing I've ever heard someone say about VR is that it'll become a thing when it's, like, in malls, and you just have a generation of people that grew up familiar with it.
It's funny, though, because, like, my roommate, who's not really into games, had come around my office, and she had played our VR, and she was, like, I think sometimes it's easy as a games person to be like, oh yeah, it's a fad. But she was just enthralled by it. And I've heard similar things from other people who are like, it's a great way to introduce your like non-game playing friends to games, which is really interesting to me because it, my gut would be that it's a very niche, you know, very tech kind of interest. But I think people who aren't interested in, you know, video games get a lot of value out of it, you know? Which is really cool.
One day, whenever they fix the whole motion sickness thing, I might try it. But I'm just like, you know what? Every time I've had a chance to try it, like a GDC or another convention, I'm like, how many thousands of people have put their face on this?
I never play it at events.
Yeah, that problem would be worse in malls.
Yeah.
There's
no way I'm playing that in an event.
Nope. Well, I mean, assuming you could even get in the queue for it, I think.
Yeah, the lines are always huge, which is really telling, right? I mean, when I was at Indiecade East, the lines for the VR games were huge. And that's, I think a lot of it's because people are curious and can't have it at home, right? So.
Yeah, because, I mean, that would be the only way I try it. And I'm like, nah, you know what? Too many cases of pink eye, like GDC.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Nah, I'm good. But one thing we wanted to ask, and, you know, we talk about identity, and we, you know, for me as a Black queer woman, a lot of the things I grew up with or learned about myself as I got older, you know, do kind of inform my work depending on the piece. But I was wondering, do people ever just make assumptions about where you're coming from in your work, either your written pieces or just things you're doing, because you're trans and, you know, you're out and you're very vocal about being trans? So I was just wondering if people make that assumption.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, I think, like, when I wrote that piece about being trans for Offworld, I think it very immediately got read in a certain way. We've talked about this before a lot, but, like, something I struggle with a lot with being trans in games writing is I think that there's only a couple narratives that people are willing to hear or that they want. And I find it hard to find space or mentors who can help me expand that narrative, right? Like, I want to move past the, like, there's a trans character in this game, so I like it, or, you know, I got to play as a boy in blah game, and that was good for me because I'm trans. And, like, none of those things are necessarily, you know, bad narratives, but I think that there's so much more that we could talk about. And at least for me, like, I feel like a lot of folks I see in games writing, I mean, one, there are very few trans men in games and games writing, which is, you know, interesting. And I don't want to sound like I'm saying there should be more men in games, which I'm definitely not saying, but it's often, like, a really interesting position. And I think there's also a lot of folks who are much earlier in their transition than me, and that shapes the narrative somewhat. And yeah, it's tricky. I'd love to see giant finger quotes diversity narratives become more nuanced and more complex. And I think there's always the allure of, you know, writing that easy piece that people will nod to. And, like, that sounds fucked up. I don't mean it that way. But, I mean, I think we can expand the dialogue. And this is what I love about, you know, like, a lot of stuff, you know, Evan Narcissor for us, or the stuff that Austin writes, are things that are bigger than just identity and thing, right? Like, I want to write about trans stuff without ever being, you know, the trans guy writing about his gender feels. And I'm often at a loss for what that means, because also, like, you know, I've been on testosterone for 13 years, I've been on as trans for, you know, 15, 16 years. Like, I don't have a lot of, you know, I can't write that piece about feeling weird about my gender necessarily. I mean, I could, because gender is terrible. We all feel weird about it. But, like, what it means for me to be trans and my trans experience is really different and has changed. And I struggle a lot to try to think about, you know, what that is or what that means, and how to convey that in a way that's valuable to readers, too. Like, I think it's easy to write. I have a ton of drafts of, you know, pieces. I think right when the Baldur's Gate stuff was happening, I wrote this, like, furious draft of a thing about, like, I feel, for me, the fact that there is a trans person in a thing is worse than if there aren't any at all. Like, the idea that there's one trans person in the entire world full of elves and dragons and whatever else is, like, the most hateful, depressing narrative. Like, it's the narrative that, you know, when I came out, my parents were like, well, you'll be alone forever and no one will ever love you. And so I'd written this, like, angry piece about it, you know, and quoted a bunch of people who had been positive about this character, and then I was like, no, this is serving you because you're upset. This isn't a thing. Like, what is this doing for readers? Like, what are you saying right now? Or are you just upset and you have a platform, so you're gonna, you know, write a thing? And I'd love to find ways to have those conversations be more nuanced and to have editors and a community that can help me push those narratives and guide me, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, it gets to be hard because, I mean, what I'm finding is if I push a diversity angle, quote-unquote, it's a lot easier to sell the piece because it's like, well, you know, you're black.
Yeah, totally.
and you're this, so you have that authority, again, quote-unquote,
yeah,
than if someone else tries to look at it and, you know, break down why diversity is not important or something like that, which it's nice to recognize expertise, but there's other things I can write about.
Yeah, exactly. And that's hard, too. Like, it sucks when that's the only thing. And I think, again, like, to go back to freelancing, that's your very unique angle, right? And so it's easy to start to do that. And it's not that it's not important, but I think it's easy to get boxed into being that person, right? And not to ever be able to write about other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to, like, write an in-depth kind of my journey through Street Fighter V piece, because I've been playing fighting games since they were in the arcade.
Awesome.
But I'm sure if I pitch that, we'd be like, well, but, you know, aren't you angry about the women in the game?
Right.
Or the one black? Exactly. It's like, come on, y'all, there's other stuff to talk about.
Yeah, but that would also color your experience, right? Like, and that's
Well, I think that that's where people lose the nuance, is that, yes, this will color my experience, but that is not that's like when you have the one tragic gay character or the one black person who's unhappy because they're the only black person. And I'm just like, okay, because it's intersectional, it's part of who you are, and it informs how you move through the world, but it is not your sole purpose of being.
Yeah, absolutely right. Like, which is hard to express, and especially in scenes like games where we're still having such a hard time, you know, getting to that place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is why I wrote that piece for Offworld and still get hate for it. So, yay.
Yeah. I mean, I love that that piece that I wrote for them, I had pitched to another outlet that shall remain nameless. and they very much tried to turn it into the trans guy has gender fields at games. And I very wisely at some point was like, yes, that's not like exactly what I'm trying to talk about. And I'm glad that I was much more like green, and so it was really hard to like take my pitch back, but I could see like several, you know, white straight cis men being like, but what if you wrote about how you feel bad about your body? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that.
No. Wise.
So it's hard.
Decision.
It would be, you know, it's, and that's hard, but I think, yeah, I wish we could. And I think we are expanding the narrative, and I think those things will continue to expand, and that's really great.
I think so. Before we get into our listener questions, we always want to, you know, give you a moment to like plug anything if you want. So is there anything new and exciting coming up?
Oh man. I don't know. not for me. Read my website. I got a website. We're still here, and not necessarily on the horizon for me, I guess. There's some cool events coming up in the world, things like that.
GamerX East.
Yeah, that's gonna be so awesome. I feel bad right now. Like, I think because I'm an editor, my first thought now is like, what are my people doing? Are they doing anything cool? But yeah, that's going to be great. I'm excited. IndieKid West is coming up soon, which I don't know if I'm going to go to, but I'm going to try. Yeah. You know, games. Work. Work is coming up.
Yeah, games. Blah.
We've just hired Heather Alexandra at my site, and she's amazing. And so that's a new exciting thing that's coming up. Read my website and all my awesome people writing all their awesome things.
Yes.
I sound like their dad. It's embarrassing. Well,
no, it's fine, but it's just like, hey, these are cool things that are coming up. Yeah. So maybe I'll poke you later about something for GameRx East.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
It'll be exciting. It'll be a good excuse to get back to New York.
Yeah.
So we did get a couple questions.
Hey.
And Garrick Winter actually sent a very, very long question, which I've tried to condense. It's an awesome question.
That's a good question.
But for the sake of brevity, I've snipped it a bit. But Garrick wanted to know, how do you balance engaging with topics people are already interested in, talking and reading about like Overwatch or No Man's Sky kind of recently, with writing about niche genres or smaller games that haven't had much exposure but may have an untapped audience?
That is a great question. We at Kotaku are very largely guided by what our writers are interested in. And so, you know, we have a ton of people, obviously, who love indie games. And so if we're excited about it, then it's, you know, newsworthy. At the same time, like, you know, big games are always going to be important. And it's tricky. I think we let folks, you know, like Nathan covers Steam and Steam games extensively, and something we often discuss is, you know, what does it mean to write about a game that a lot of people might not have heard of, and, you know, how much traffic will it do or whatever. And I think it's, we can do a good service to highlighting things that we like. And so, yeah, we've never said, oh, don't write about that, it's an indie game. Like, we're always for doing that stuff. And, like, I'll get a lot of, you know, sometimes you get reader comments that are like, why are you writing about this? What the hell is this? But there's always, like, that one or two people, like, I've written about super tiny games where one or two people will be like, ah, oh, it's my favorite. And I'm like, yay. And so we do everything, I guess. But it's definitely important to us to write about indie games as well as bigger stuff. And we always want to be guided by what, you know, people are talking about. And so that's, like, important. I don't know if that entirely answers the question. How do we do it? We do it. We're all very tired and busy, but we do it.
Tim asks, what's one piece you've written, whether for Kotaku or another outlet, that you're incredibly proud of?
I'm really proud of my Offworld piece. There's parts of it that I would revise now because it's been a couple years, but I'm proud of how that piece came off. A while ago for Kotaku, I reviewed Half-Life 2, and so I'm pretty proud of that. And just in terms of, like, feeling like a fanboy and being like, Riley McLeod reviews Half-Life 2 for Kotaku. Like, yeah. So I'm really happy about that one. I wrote a piece a while ago about The Long Dark, where I got to talk a little bit about the history of polar exploration, which I am obsessed with, and so I'm really proud of that. Because I had a bunch of stuff and I was going to cut it out, and then my Steven, our EIC, was like, that's so interesting. And I was like, you think it's interesting? Okay. like, I'm just going to nerd out for 600 words about polar exploration. I'm like, hooray. Non-game stuff, I would say... I would have played back in undergrad I was proud of. you know, I've done a lot of non-game stuff, a lot of fiction and theater and stuff like that. A lot of what I'm proud of has been things I've facilitated. I mean, like, things I've edited, or I put on a theater festival in 2003 that I'm really proud of. I was the editor on this book, Nevada, by Imogen Binney, which has been a really influential trans book, and I'm incredibly proud of my work on that. Yeah, I'm proud of lots of things I've edited. Tons of things I've edited for our site. Yeah.
Cool. Tim's other question is, who are a couple writers whose writing you never want to miss? It doesn't necessarily have to be games writing.
Well, in games, I would say definitely Austin Walker. I think that if he's listening to this, that guy's a genius. I love Austin's work, and it I think to get back to the question about like trans stuff, like I feel like his work always pushes me to be better. Like I think he's able to write about, you know, finger quotes diversity stuff without ever being that guy writing about that thing. You know what I mean? And his work constantly inspires and motivates me. The stuff that Todd Harper writes, he's always like, Todd is so good at distilling like that thing we're mad about into like some brilliant, sensible argument. And I'm just always, you know, shocked and impressed with that. J.V. Gwaltney, I think, is amazing, and I hope that he's running this industry 5 years from now. I think J.V. should just run games. Geeta Jackson's stuff, I think, equally is just fierce as shit, and she's always has such awesome things to say. Not games-wise, William Gibson, I guess, and Dennis Cooper. They're a little weird books. I guess none of those people have put out books in a while. What else? Who else? I just kind of, like, glance at my bookshelf. Yeah, that seems pretty right.
Cool. Let's see. Wow, it's interesting how kind of the same folks always get name dropped.
No,
this isn't a bad thing. It just like gives me like that little fangirl moment of I know all of these people.
It's true.
Because I was on a panel with Austin, and I would just be like. Okay, I'm just going to sit here and listen to you sound very, very smart.
Yeah, I introduced him at a keynote for different games last year, and he sent me his, like, talk, which you can see on the internet, right before it, and I was reading it, and I was just like, oh, fuck you, you're so smart, I can't stand it, like, I'll never be good enough.
No, you will, don't say that. I'm sure Austin would yell at you if he hears you.
Yeah. He definitely like I was saying, I mean, his work I think is going in and already embodies that direction that I'd love to see trans conversations and other diversity like questions go, right? Like he's able to have these nuanced, rich conversations that I often think like either readers or outlets won't let you have. And yeah, he's great, man. That guy's great.
He's either going to, like, send us a text or be like, his ears are burning right now.
He's going to be mad. Let's call him.
I mean, actually, I don't know if I have his number, but that would be really weird if we could, like, live call him during recording.
Austin.
Hopefully his ears are burning. But, you know, we've talked about a lot of stuff, and, you know, we're suddenly kind of winding down. And the way we like to finish off the show is to talk about what we've been playing or reading or writing, you know, if we haven't had a lot of time for gaming recently. And since you are our esteemed guest, you get to go first.
Well, I just finished Deus Ex Mankind Divided. Last week I had vacation, or the week before last I had vacation, so I played a bunch of games. So yeah, I finished Deus Ex. I finally played Wolfenstein The Old Blood. As I said before, I love Wolfenstein, so Old Blood wasn't... It wasn't Wolfenstein the way Wolfenstein was Wolfenstein, but it was still, like, pretty okay. I've been playing a ton of Overwatch. I feel like it's one of those games that I can play, like, oh, I'm just going to play one round, and then all my friends are on, and I'm like, all right, fine. And it's like, oh, it's 2 a.m, what happened? I recently picked up Elite Dangerous again, because there's been a bunch of cool stuff happening in there. And I bought a flight stick. I had this ridiculous Thrustmaster, like, flight stick throttle thing that I bought because I was like, I have a job now, yeah. And so over the weekend I decided to jump back into Elite with it, having forgotten that Elite is incredibly complicated, and now I had all new buttons, and so it was like kind of a really tragic disaster where I was like, yeah, oh no, why do I have this ship, where am I, what do my buttons do, like what have I done? But I'd love to, you know, it's the sad irony of working in games is that I have so little time to play games, and I often am just like, I just want to play so many games. I've fiddled with like working out a schedule of like every day I'm going to play an hour of Elite and an hour of Ark and then an hour of this and an hour of that, and then I always want to play this thing and then I should really play this thing, and then it's like, oh man, like this is just impossible.
Too many games, not enough hours.
I know, which is a wonderful problem to have, all things considered.
True.
What about you all?
David, would you like to go first?
Sure. I haven't actually played any video games at all since we last recorded, but I have. In the last episode, I mentioned I made a radio while I was tinkering with Starbound's thing. And so what I have done today is I've uploaded it to the Steam Workshop, so it's available. It plays the radio show from Bloodlines, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, because I'm pretty sure that they're not... But, you know, Troika is not really a thing, so.
That's so cool.
Very few people will complain about that.
That's cool. I played a ton of Starbound when it was early access, and then tried to jump back in and just haven't had the time, but it seems like it's really great now that it's out.
Yeah, there's like such a like rich modding thing. Like, modding is like built into its premise. Everything is very accessible, and it's all just like JavaScript object notation.
Cool.
Yeah, it does. You've lost me with JavaScript because that was the one class I took twice and couldn't pass it.
No, it's just the object notation, just defining things, and then the game does the rest.
I took the class twice and still couldn't pass it.
Yeah, you know, come on. The object notation, duh.
If it was Ruby on Rails.
Yeah, so I have sort of like fallen into Starbound the way I did like in high school with Morrowind. Where it's just like I start to understand just how the game works. And
interesting.
You know, when you tinker with stuff and it's moddable.
Yeah, I had a fleeting idea to try to make some Dragon Age Inquisition mods and was like, haha, sucker, nope. Because Frostbite is no joke. I barely made something for Origin, so yeah, I got sucked into Stardew Valley.
Fun. I haven't played that.
It's fun. You know, it's very calming because you're basically just out there farming. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go, like, break up some rocks for 6 hours in my farm. That's cool. And it's just very chill. I'm like, you know, there's not combat. I'm not fighting anything. I'm just out here with a scythe and an axe pick and a bunch of stuff. So that works. So speaking of which, I should check on my crops when we're done recording. Hopefully it's not like Farmville where shit will die if you don't log in. And I actually... got back into The Witcher 3. I started a new game, not a new game plus, because fuck a new game plus. A level 30 griffin is no fun to take on with like one crossbow. But a lot of friends have been streaming it and playing it so they could go, you know, go through the DLC. And I'm like, you know what? I kind of miss Velen and all these other places. And I never really sunk into it the way I did with Dragon Age. I have a lot of like side quests and other stuff that I never really got into, and just decided, you know what, new game, gonna do all the stuff I missed, and you know, like, replay it probably on stream.
Awesome. See, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna play The Witcher.
Yay.
One day, I'm gonna find the time.
Or just watch me stream it, and you can live vicariously.
There are so many games that I talk about that I mostly have just watched on the internet. The other, while I was on vacation, I was trying to decide if I wanted to play RimWorld, which I think I totally do, but I just started watching it on YouTube, and then I just got sucked into like a YouTube hole of watching it, and then I was like telling my colleagues this because we were talking about it, and I was like, yeah, you know, I couldn't decide if I wanted to play it, so I just wound up watching a ton of it on YouTube, and they were like, that's a very Riley story. It seems like, and then just get really invested in somebody else playing it, and then be like, all right, that's pretty good.
Do you ever watch those videos on YouTube where it's like the cutscenes together?
Only if I'm trying to look something up, I think. Those are cool.
I actually watched one recently that was the cutscenes from Starfleet Academy and Klingon Academy cut together, and the plot almost seems like a movie. And, you know, William Shatner's in it.
Yeah. I don't know. I like Let's Plays. Sometimes I used to, when I was freelancing, sometimes I would watch like long Let's Play series because it was just like the right amount of sound that I needed. But it's like somebody's kind of, and they would always be Let's Plays of things like RimWorld or these like, or like, you know, City Skylines or things that like you don't have to pay attention to. But it was just like somebody's talking about like words I understand. This is great. Or I'll watch Let's Plays of like, you know, console only games I don't have or stuff like that.
I have RimWorld. I'm terrible at it. Everyone died in, like, the first 3 days.
It looks neat. I'm obsessed with, like, I think all survival games should have mood meters, and so it has, like, mood stuff, so I really want to play it because I'm like, what? They can be unhappy. Hooray! Like, I just think that's a great survival mechanic.
Yeah, I got into it because Mike Laidlaw was streaming it. That was kind of like his Wednesday evening thing to stream, and he'd, like, pop up on weekends. And it was really interesting, and there's actually something I just retweeted the other day about RimWorld, and it was just something that caught my eye. But it's like, I kind of want to go back to it, but it's not really intuitive, and I get frustrated. Yeah. So maybe one day I'll get to play it, or I'll put it on my laptop or something, and since I'm flying everywhere in the next month. But yeah, or I'll just be playing Stardew Valley on the flight, and no one will have to talk to me.
Nice.
Speaking of people talking to you, sadly, we are at our end. I don't want to stop talking to you because you're awesome.
Aw, sucks. Y'all are awesome too, yay.
Thank you. But you're always welcome to come back and talk to us, or if you just want to come hang out, and hopefully maybe we can get you back on after GamerX East so you can talk about how that was for you.
How great it will be. I'm pretty excited.
That'll be cool. So where can folks find you online, Riley?
Man, folks can find me on Twitter at Riley R.C. McLeod. It's R-C-M-A-C-L-E-O-D. Or on Kotaku, and I assume you'll provide a link to that, which I'm copy-pasting right now into your doc.
Yes.
Like a scumbag. And now I'm looking at all the things I've written, which are so many. I've written so many news blips about Hitman. just all Hitman. So, yeah.
Internet. Cool. All the internets. David, where can folks find you on the internets?
I can be found on Twitter at Red Conversation. I can be found at davidoreeves.com, which tells you the email address you need to email if you require editorial services of any kind.
Nice.
And I do need more people. I really do. So.
Everyone needs an editor. Cough, cough.
Not subtle at all.
No.
Either of you.
Sorry.
And I guess if you try it, you could find me on Steam, because I copied the URL of that that stupid radio to the show notes.
Yeah.
We'll play the radio. It'll be awesome. And you are also on Patreon, correct?
Yes, I am. It's Red Conversation on Patreon as well. It's patreon.com/redconversation. That's also where we're posting. We've started another podcast. It's about movies. By the time anyone hears this, the podcast will have episodes talking about the Jurassic Park as a franchise, The Matrix, and Dark City, which came out around the same time and have the same themes. Dark City is like we ended up calling it the Sis Matrix. It's kind of weird, actually, how the metaphor pans out. Children of Men, which is just an excellent movie all around. I have no idea if it'll be interesting to listen to us talk about it.
Hell, I'll come talk about it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
Yeah, and that's where people can find me. Tanya, where can people find you?
I'm pretty much Cypher Tier everywhere online. That is CypherOftyr, and that is Tears in the Nordic Deity, not Tears in the Heavy Metal Band, as I'm finding out people seem to think, or Tiromancy, which is divination through cheese, which I learned because of The Witcher. Huh. So, yes, divination through cheese. It's a thing. So, yeah, Cypher Tier, or find me at I Need Diverse Games. If you Google either of those, hopefully I will be the first hit that comes up. If not, don't tell me, because then I'll cry. That is the end of episode 68. Next week, we will talk to Leisha Riddle, and she is going to come talk about Project Solus and a lot of her other work.
Oh, cool.
And she gave a really, really good talk last year at GamerX 3, so I'm really excited to talk to Leisha about her work, because she's a phenomenal artist and just an all-around awesome person. So that'll be episode 69. See you in a week. Bye.